Okay, how does that sound? Yeah, thanks for coming out tonight. That's great. What a wonderful bunch of people here. I wanted to say, too, that one of the things that's very gratifying for me is that, with one exception, everybody who's reading tonight is a former student of mine. The one exception is Michael Worster, but I think I was a teacher of his, or he was a teacher of me, I should say, when I first came to Pittsburgh and later. And one of the things that's absolutely wonderful, I think, is to watch people who you've had in seminar read their wonderful poems. Everyone else here has been a student of mine, and I absolutely love to hear students who graduated from Pitt or from Bennington MFA, where I'm teaching now, read poems from their books. You understand, I am not responsible for them, but my claim is I didn't fuck them up too much either. And so they write and do well. The one exception to that is Jimmy Savetic, I think, who was in some ways a little bit slow. It took 10 years or 12 years of me saying, why don't you write some of those goddamn stories you're telling out of your police life? And he finally did. And he finally has. And they're wonderful, wonderful things. So I love Jimmy dearly, but it took him a little bit longer than some other folks. Okay. Let me read a few poems. This is the new book. This is the opening poem in it called Steel City. And it has a quote, change is the great subject of poetry, which is a quote from me. Change is the great subject of poetry, and speed, I would add. I envy the poets of New York, so many weird people to see and shops to name, restaurants in which to meet other poets and complain about overpriced borscht. And I am a New Yorker by birth, living in exile, not like Catullus, who is bitter about it, but in a city that boasts the original hot dog shop, the secret of its great fries, molten lard, not too far from a real carousel with real little kids screaming for joy, not too far from where Maz hit the home run that beat the hated Yankees in 1960, and that not too far from the conservatory with a statue of Bobby Burns standing next to a plow, whose handle, when viewed from a certain angle, looks remarkably like a giant crooked penis extending from Bobby Burns' knickers, a fact that has always allowed me to make jokes about the physiology of Scotsmen, who may be the only ethnic group not subject to PC constraints. Perhaps because of antipathy to Andrew Carnegie, the evil Scot who screwed the workers and then gave them a library, as well as layers of black grime for all their buildings, as well as their lungs, a coating still black as priests on the older structures, as now teenagers make out on park benches after eating lard-infused fries, and the little kids on the carousel yell, more, more, to their sagging parents, as endless automobiles circle looking to park, and a flotilla of balloons, red, white, yellow, and green this afternoon, floats toward the Empyrean, powder blue above the clouds, scudding before the tireless wind. Don't clap, because I'm going to read a few poems. If you don't clap, I'll feel terribly badly. So just listen and see what happens. This is a poem called Poetry. I, too, dislike it. The mystified truisms, the dusty puzzle prunes, the theatrical exaggerations, the brutal crescendo of woodworms. And yet, I think of Frank O'Hara's delight in the endless pleasures of quotidian life, and Duhamel throwing a dozen balls in the air and juggling them all. Frank said only a few poems are as good as the movies, but that was a long time ago, before a lot of bad movies, before background music, before there was almost no silence, and the private life is an insult to others. Poetry is the most private art. Lee Young, remembering his father, combing his mother's hair, Stern and Gilbert with their mouths open, walking down a street in Paris, Judith writing the mysteries of Level Green and her father's radioactive chambers, Catullus registering his private ecstasies and fears while the machine of the state ground on, Kinnell saying, go so deep into yourself, you speak for everyone. There's one called The Death of Hemingway. I heard the radio report as I drove with my girlfriend to breakfast at a place in Cambridge Square that was very fashionable for omelets that year. I should say that there are a group of quotations from Hemingway in italics in the poem. I think I'll just go like that when I read them. Certainly start again. I heard the radio report as I drove with my girlfriend to breakfast at a place in Cambridge Square that was very fashionable for omelets that year. When we came back to Paris, it was clear and cold and lovely. We couldn't believe he had killed himself, not with a shotgun. What a way of saying fuck you to his friends, the ones who would have to clean it up. We ate our omelets and drove out to the Cape. My fantasy that year was that the sun at Truro was so strong you could hold your hand up to it and see bones through the flesh. Morley Callahan, who boxed with him, quoted Hemingway, they always praise you for the worst aspects of your work. It never fails. Callahan's fine book, That Summer in Paris, is out of print in America, and no one I mention it to has ever heard of it. A few years ago, a young novelist I like said, no one really admires Hemingway anymore. And it's true that time has done a job on him and his macho poses. We swam and danced a lot that summer at the Cape. We're always lucky, I said, and like a fool, I did not knock on wood. I dated one of the Walker girls, and at the Art Center's costume balls, we won first prize from Abe Burrows, who wrote the book for Guys and Dolls and was famous long ago. Though this poem isn't about nostalgia, wherever or whomever you are, time will change it. Sometimes there's nothing there. Well, nothing left. Nada, he said. Nada. There's a little poem called Karaoke Night at the Serbian Club, Southside, Pittsburgh, which incidentally is a haiku. Two young, toothless men with enormous gusto sing, Stairway to Heaven. I was reading this out of town a couple of weeks ago, and someone said afterward, why were they singing Stairway to Heaven? And I just, too much of the mysteries of Pittsburgh, you know, to have to explain. Okay, let me read two more. I just heard this afternoon that one of the poets we published at the University of Pittsburgh Press, Ross Gay, has just come into a large monetary, prize, which I was very happy to hear. And this is a poem called Ross Gay. I sent an email to Ross Gay. Congratulations on the Times review of Bringing the Shovel Down, though even in a good review of poetry, there's almost always a snotty little quibble, unless the poet's dead or English. This reviewer hates shimmering labia. Yes, said Ross, I laughed about that too. Maybe it started when the hordes of theory PhDs rose over the horizon and poisoned all the books they landed on. Luckily, then they started to kill each other off. We can use split infinitives now. But around that time, American poets began to write about John Clare, the mad, sweet nature poet lost in an unjust world. One of the theory people I worked with wrote a novel, unpublished, so bad cats and dogs might double over, which deepened her hatred of her irrational colleagues publishing poetry and fiction. Perhaps Yogi Berra explained it best, and note that Yogi, like the poet we call Homer, is growing by incremental repetition and now has an enormous oeuvre. Yogi said, in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice, there is. Okay, let me read one more than I thought. This is a poem called Ancient Music. Driving out of Pittsburgh, Brandenburg number 6 on FM, Bach sent it to the Markgrave with his job application that was turned down, the music lost for 100 years. So much sweetness hidden. I heard it first at 18 in the Cornell music room. I'd never listened much to classical. And now, scribbling this on the porch that overlooks the meadow, Verl mode for hay, before his early death, crushed by machine, I watched the hills rising, wooded, and beyond them, mountains upon mountains, and miles, and years away the ocean, below the surf, anemones and whelks, hidden, waving, on the shores of darkness. There is light. You know, what the hell? Let me read another one. thank you. One of the poets I like very much in this world and also publish is a guy named Afo Weaver. Michael Weaver, who, like me, is a great baseball fan. By the way, St. Louis lost its first game of a doubleheader, so I'm not sure. There's a rain delay at Pittsburgh, but it's just possible that if St. Louis loses again and the Pirates win, the Pirates will be a game and a half up again, 4.5 out. Wow. Anyway, Mike Weaver and I, last summer, were corresponding about a couple of things, including baseball. And this is a poem called Emails from and to Afo Weaver. Ed, I was thinking about you the other day when I left my acting class. I'm still working on my play, Fences, building my character, Troy Maxim. Anyway, I was thinking about you and baseball. My father loved it, as do you. So as part of my work on Maxim, I signed up for MLB TV this week. My father would come home from the steel mill and stretch out across his bed in the evening, his radio turned to a game. I was watching the Cardinals and Mets the other day, moving around between my work table and the kitchen, watching and listening and remembering how things were. It's funny, too, reading about how August Wilson moved away from Pittsburgh and the world of his plays began to speak to him. I feel that way about Baltimore now. I feel good about City of Eternal Spring and it's coming along. It's leading me back to what I know of Baltimore and being in that life, in the factory, using the past and treasuring it rather than trying to forget it or live in it. Yesterday, the announcer in one game said, "Pitchers don't try to deceive anymore. Now it's all about speed." I suppose rhythm, too. That says a lot about our world, I guess. Hi, Mike. Amazing coincidence. I'm at Bennington now and decided yesterday that I want to hear pirate games. So I signed up for MLB radio. It's true what you say about speed, but some pitchers still know how to deceive. Our closer, Grilly, is a guy with a good fastball who can also mix it up. Your father knew about curves and sliders. I've said it before that speed is something I like in poetry, not just speed for its own sake. Speed to get to the heart of things and not just fuck around. Speaking of curveballs, in a new book, Daisy Freed has a speaker with an advice column called Ask the Poetess, who refers to all poets as poetesses and observes that one of the great recent poetesses is Charles Bukowski. I'm just reading Don Hall's The Back Chamber, among other things, lots of baseball in it, including a really good poem called Meatloaf. You love it, I think, and so would your father. Old Baltimore, old Pittsburgh, old New York. Time turns pain to silver, garbage to gold. And this is the last one. It jumps back in time. It's a poem called What You Should Know About the Emperor Nero. It's in 13 parts, which seems appropriate for Nero. And it's a prose poem, I guess. One, think of the worst open mic reading you've ever attended. And then multiply it by 1,000 to have a vague idea of the impenetrable boredom, the idiocy of a poetry reading by Nero, who was devoted to the arts and would require your presence at performances that stretched for hours, sometimes days, as the pudgy little bugger strutted on stage with his lyre. Two, he had no trouble getting published and won numerous poetry prizes. Three, at his readings, people fell over and feigned death so they could be carried out by their slaves, while others, like untenured American professors, swooned in false ecstasy. Four, remember this the next time a scrawny kid with a guitar and suspicious stains on his jeans stands up and says, "I'd like to sing you a few poems about Jesus." Five, despite what you've heard, he wasn't very successful at rounding up Christians to feed to the lions, mainly some poor gapers who didn't know enough to come in from the rain. Six, thus Nero is directly responsible for 2,000 years of guilt and bad sex, not to mention pogroms, hundreds of thousands of deaths in the Crusades, dozens of popes named Innocent, the massacres in Piedmont, John Milton, the Spanish Inquisition, and Pat Robertson. 7. Also, the Emperor Constantine's fib about seeing a cross in the sky and the words, in hoc signo vinces, in this sign conquer, which later became the slogan for Paul Mall cigarettes. 8. Nero was probably not responsible for burning down Rome, which after all would not be in his particular interest. 9. Nor could he fiddle. 10. He also failed at numerous attempts to murder his mother, who had poisoned his stepfather Claudius so that Nero could ascend to the throne, but was always nagging him about his deportment, such as pissing off the nobles by holding perfectly disgraceful orgies of a sort distinctly un-Roman. 11. He tried various gambits. His most inventive, the construction of a collapsible ship, which he gave his mother as a birthday present, and which fell apart when she went for a sail. 12. Imagine his frustration and chagrin when she managed to swim to shore. And he was forced to have her unartistically strangled. 13. When his stern nemesis, Galba, approached with an army and all was lost, Nero asked his one remaining faithful slave to run him through with his own sword, after declaring in a grand theatrical manner, "What a talent the world now loses." Now there, friends, was a poet.
Thank you.